I am John Cryer, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. On this week's show, we'll be talking about episode 7 of our Dennis Perry arc, Mixtape, which revealed that the only thing more intriguing than the information we have is the information we don't. So with us today are Colin Miller. He's an associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. I can never say that right. What is my deal, Colin? Welcome to the show, Colin.
Hey, John, how's it going?
Maybe someday I'll get it right. I should get it right on my very last episode.
Yes,
that
yes,
would
that
just
would
be
a good parting shot.
That would just be a good parting shot. Also with us is Susan Simpson. She is an associate of the Volkov Law Group and also the host of the 45th podcast. Hello, Susan.
Hey, John.
Hey, you've got a lot to talk about this week on the 45th podcast.
Why do they always time like the big drops for like Mondays and Tuesdays? I swear it's on purpose.
It's crazy. It's absolutely bonkers. Yeah, that episode is going to be lit. Are you going to wait a couple of days to do? You could get away with a special episode of the 45th now, you know, if no other time, for God's sakes.
If Rabia was in town, I'd try it, but she is not.
Oh, Rabia, history is happening. I'm sorry, I'm quoting Hamilton now. I apologize. So once again, terrific episode, episode 7. It looks like we get to talk about document retention again. Woohoo! Document retention! obviously a big part of Mixtape was the missing tapes that were made. Who were they made by again? They were made by
Butch Kennedy.
Butch Kennedy, thank you.
The original deputy from the Camden County Sheriff's Office who was on the case.
Yeah. Got it. He was not the guy from the GBI.
No.
Okay. But the prosecutor waved around transcripts that were made from these tapes. Where did they get the transcripts from and who made them?
So the transcripts, actually, we know we have about seven. I haven't counted exactly, but around there. And they were probably about four or five of them are typed up. And they were made by a woman named Mary Root. She lived in South Camden County. And Butch Kennedy testified that his practice was to have, you know, he'd fill up the tapes and give them to her and have her type up a transcript for him. Interestingly, Mary Root was actually on the grand jury the term that Dennis was indicted. And she was struck off from the jurors who participated in the decision. The grand jury in Camden County was not recorded. There were no notes. There was no information preserved. So we actually have no idea what happened at the grand jury, what was said, who testified. We don't know a thing about it. So we don't know why certain grand jurors did not participate in the decision. But I do wonder if Mary Root was excused from this, considering Dennis Perry's indictment, because she had personal knowledge of the case.
Well, that would stand to reason. Now, you're saying some of them were typed. Were some of them handwritten?
Yes. At least two of them were painfully labored. Like, they're just handwritten the whole thing, like probably 30 pages each.
That is just a fascinating bit of trivia. Well, in the spirit of that, you have been down there. You have been down to the area in which this occurred. Have you actually seen, because when photos came out of Baltimore's filing system, as it were, which apparently was like a hoarder system where they just threw it into a room and hoped for the best. One has to hope that their system is better down there.
Oh, no.
No? Oh, gosh.
No. They have no idea where anything is, ever. We've been told so many things. I half my time in Camden County is like going from place to place where I'm told evidence might be. And I go there, they're like, no, it's not here. Go somewhere else. So they have no idea where any of their stuff is. And I don't know if that's because they don't know where it is or they're telling us they don't know where it is. I will say the Camden County DA's office has been organized the whole time. They seem to know where all their stuff is. They have no problem finding it. They are alone in that regard for like every agency in Glynn County and Camden County.
Well, and this is a very widespread problem. I mean, obviously, I brought up Baltimore, but this is an enormous amount of documents that have to be kept, tapes that have to be kept, evidence that have to be kept. And evidence can be anything. You know, I mean, if somebody gets murdered with a table leg, they've got to find some place to put a table leg, you know. So I understand that why police departments have difficulty with this.
Yeah, it's an old case. So, like, you know, even in a best case scenario, it wouldn't be surprising if stuff went missing. But the sheer mass of stuff that went missing is bizarre here, especially the timing of when it went missing, because trial wasn't, well, the case reopened in 98. So, like, if they lost it before 98, I might excuse it. Not excuse it, but I don't get understanding. But the idea that it's a 13-year-old case, they reopen it, and then they keep losing evidence from that point on, That's inexcusable.
And as you said, there's no evidence left. It's all gone at this point. Am I correct?
It's all gone. I say that because it's what I've been told. I don't believe it. Like, we literally have records showing that in, like, 2016, they signed for it and had it in their possession. So it couldn't have gone too far.
I had a question about these transcripts. Obviously, the prosecution was waving around in the air, you know, making a big show that there were transcripts, so the tapes not existing supposedly didn't matter anymore. So did the defense have access to these transcripts?
They did, although for a while. I remember when I started working on the case, I was talking with Christina Cribbs, who was the GIP attorney that originally handled it, and she was trying to figure out if they had it or not, and her first guess was that they hadn't because the defense doesn't use them in any way. I mean, the perfect example is Cora Fisher's transcript, where she says that she saw a guy with brownish, blackish hair. And then at trial, she's like, or at the deposition, she's like, oh, he had sandy, blondish, whitish hair. And you'd think that if he actually read the transcript, he would have been like, no. So he never actually used the information on there. We assume they read it, but they should have had access to it. Like I said, we have like maybe 5 type transcripts and then like maybe a couple more handwritten ones. And then we think probably maybe 5 or 6 more interviews for sure that are not transcribed at all. Plus, at least 1 or 2 of the transcripts we have aren't listed on the index sheet. So we actually have no idea how many recorded interviews there were.
I have another question about the defense. Did they ever bring up the Roberson document?
No, I haven't seen no indication they ever saw that document. Not that it wasn't handed over, but that they never like bothered to read it, or I don't know. As far as I can tell, they either ignored it or just overlooked it somehow.
And to recap, the Roberson document is the document that the former sheriff's deputy turned in, where he attested to the fact that he saw somebody driving erratically away from the scene. Is that correct?
The Roberson thing, I mean, so he handed it in the next day after the murders. He'd obviously gotten home, you know, the next day, woke up, heard about these crazy, like, unusual murders at Rising Daughter Baptist Church, and he thinks back and is like, wow, I passed by Rising Daughter, and about where I was passing my Rising Daughter, I saw this car driving weirdly. I should report it. So he took the initiative to, like, get one of his pre-printed forms he still had for, like, a voluntary statement. Because he'd stopped being a deputy by that point. He was working for, like, a telephone company. But still, he had the form. So he filled it out, brought it down, handed it in. And that's the last he ever heard of it. Which means at the time he handed it in, he didn't know major details of the crime. He didn't know the exact timing. He didn't know the exact, like, what was known about the car, what was known about the people involved. Like, he didn't know any of that. He would have known that, you know, a white guy was seen driving. Or a white guy was seen at the scene. So maybe that part he could have gotten from reports. But based on where he'd been that night, at a seminar at a church not far away on Blythe Island, and the time it got out, the time he would have been passing by Rising Daughter was like a minute after Margie Moore had fled the church to seek help.
So we know this document was retained with the case records that you did find, correct?
No, it's there now. I can't guarantee it was always there.
But wouldn't, if the prosecution had not turned this over, wouldn't that constitute a Brady violation?
I don't think in this case the prosecution, one, I think it's very possible the defense did have it. It was with documents the defense did have access to. So my guess is they could have had it and overlooked it. And I don't think the prosecution was responsible there. It seems like it may have gotten put in some other file. I honestly don't know. It's hard to tell what happened with it. It does not seem to me from the way the files were kept that there was like an intentional Brady violation here.
But that importantly doesn't matter. As long as the police have it or the prosecutor has it or anyone in law enforcement has it, regardless of bad faith or good faith, if they have this information and it's material and exculpatory, that would be a Brady violation. Now, if the defense got it, then it's a dead letter. But yeah, if the defense didn't get it, I think, John, you're probably right. There is a decent argument. We don't know exactly what Roberson would have said, but certainly a decent chance he would have said this person was definitely not Dennis Perry.
Yeah, he did not get a great look at the face. And he was a really interesting guy. He was he did not want to be quoted for the podcast. I think his concern was still from a law enforcement perspective. He didn't want to say something that contradicted his written statement, because whatever was in the statement was what he saw back then. And he was afraid if he remembered it wrong now, he might somehow contradict that, I guess. Understandably, that, you know, he trusted what he said then and doesn't trust entirely what he says now about what he recalls about it. And I wish he'd been recorded, because he was a really interesting, observant guy with some interesting ideas about law enforcement in general. And I completely believe him. Like, I have zero doubts about this guy's credibility in what he saw that night. Like, he absolutely saw that. And it based on the timing, which again, he couldn't have known when he wrote that statement. It would have put him there right at the exact time to see the killer drive away, if the killer drove away.
But I imagine the prosecution argument would be, well, we don't know that this is exculpatory. Obviously, you see that in other places where there's a high hurdle for defense lawyers to try and get decisions overturned based on evidence that's, as you guys have mentioned, it's a high hurdle to prove that that would have been exculpatory, correct?
It is. And I really don't get a sense from the files that the prosecution recognizes the document either. They must have read it at some point because they've like written down people who are listed in the files. And they do list Paul Robertson. So they've seen his name before. As the prosecutor, not the defense, not the police, but the if when I've seen, I don't actually believe that anyone in the police or the prosecution side really paid attention to it.
Yeah, and John, I think you're right. It's tough, especially with the amount of time that passed here between the crime and the prosecution. It's just so tough to say what they could have tracked down at the time of the trial. So I mean, I think it could have been important, but yeah, it would be tough to really seal the deal and be able to say, oh, this is really key evidence that would have influenced the jury in their verdict.
And Paul Robertson never followed up on it. I mean, you know, this was, to his eye, somebody driving erratically. I mean, often police officers just report that anyway. You know, wouldn't it have been possibly a drunk driver or something like that, some issue that the police should have actually been aware of?
Possibly. I guess he decided it was not worth reporting at the time. I mean, the driver was having trouble staying in the lanes. Mm-hmm. That's really what he noticed, which it doesn't necessarily mean drunk. And plus, in that day, he wouldn't have gotten home for 20 minutes. What goes to call it in then? Because there's no cell phone.
I'd be interested to hear. I don't know. I haven't actually looked into this. But it was, as you say, Susan, he's having trouble staying in his lane, but he's also driving really slowly. Is that typical for drunk driving, where it's slow and erratic, or is it fast and erratic? Or does anyone have any insight on that?
No.
I have seen people driving very slow and erratically who were clearly impaired. And I remember growing up in rural Indiana. I grew up in New York City, but I used to spend my summers in rural Indiana. And you could tell when somebody was driving home and really shouldn't have been.
Handy is the easy and convenient way to book home cleanings on a schedule that works for you. With Handy, you can book home cleanings on your schedule right from the app or website. You can compare profiles and read real customer reviews to find the perfect pro for your needs. All of Handy's services are backed by the Handy Happiness Guarantee. There have been over 3 million cleanings done with Handy. And with Handy's clear upfront pricing, what you see is what you pay. And you can pay securely on the app, so there's no need to worry about cash or checks. Here's how it works. You simply tell Handy the number of bedrooms and bathrooms in your house and pick the date and time you'd like your home cleaned. You tell Handy your cleaning priorities so your pro knows what's most important to you. Then, Handy will match you with one of their top-rated pros, where you can read real customer reviews and select the pro you'd like to hire. Loved your cleaner? You can add them to your pro team to use for future bookings. Now, I've never used a cleaning service in my life, but I've been really busy with Undisclosed in the start of the school year, so I decided to give Handy a try. The cleaning was easy to set up, the cleaners were completely professional, and they did a great job. And now, Undisclosed listeners, you can try Handy too. To get your first 3-hour cleaning for $39 when you sign up for a plan, visit handy.com/undisclosed and use the promo code undisclosed during checkout. Recurring charge terms and conditions apply. Visit handy.com to learn more. That's handy.com/undisclosed and use the promo code undisclosed.
The part that stood out to me, though, was his description of the guy covering up his like side view mirror. Mm-hmm. Because at least for me, that's all. I mean, when I don't have my glasses on, I'm trying to drive at night. I mean, I don't do that because I can't. But for me, and I'm not that as blind as this person was, whoever had the glasses, but the lights overwhelm my eyes. Like all I see is like the blurry lights, and they kind of blur together to fill my whole vision. So I can understand someone who's trying to drive without glasses why you'd be really interested in making sure you don't have the glare in your eyes, because that would diminish your already poor vision.
It's interesting. My wife was just seeing her ophthalmologist the other day, and they gave her this new test she had never taken before. She and I are both nearsighted, and the test said basically your vision is whatever, 20/50 without glasses. But at nighttime, because of something she has in her eyes, it's actually worse, like 20/60 or 20/70. So I don't know what the test was, but I wonder if that might be playing a role here too. If this person didn't have their glasses and had bad vision, it could be accentuated, as far as I can tell from this test, by being driving at night.
Now, you mentioned in the podcast that there was only actually one of these suspects whose vision would actually be improved by the glasses that that were found on the scene. Did all the other people have, who were considered possible suspects because of needing glasses or whatever, did they have a wildly different prescription?
Yeah, they. I'd even say most suspects didn't even wear glasses, but the minority who did, they typically tried to check for the prescription, go to the doctor, find out they had. And this one guy, Kevin, he did not match prescription. His eyes are even worse still by quite a bit. But this prescription was like a partial way towards what his eyes were. So if he put on these glasses, his vision would be improved, but not made perfect again. Whereas everyone else would just be like worse off if they put it on.
So I wanted to get to the Lottie Bell Clayton account. So no one ever followed up on that at all?
No. And as far as I can, again, we only have partial files. We have it's like an archaeologist record here. We have bits and pieces of fossils showing there was once a whole dinosaur somewhere in there. But we're trying to theorize based on a leg bone and a jawbone or something. So all I've got for Lottie Bell Clayton, literally in the whole file, is the transcript of her interview and the index sheet that has her name on it. And she died many years ago. Her daughter died. It drives me crazy because there's literally nothing I can do now that I've been able to figure out to follow up on this.
Another intriguing lead was Leona Hamilton Reed, who worked at the Reed's store there, who actually may well have dealt with the assailant who bought the Pepsi from her. First of all, I'm sorry, I have to point out, you ask for a Coke in Georgia, you get a Coke.
I know. I couldn't figure it out. I'm like, were they out of Cokes? I mean, you also, at the same time, when you in Georgia, it's pretty typical to say, hey, I want a Coke. Okay, what do you want? A Sprite or a root beer or a Coke?
Yeah, yeah.
So it could have been he just said, hey, do you got Coke? Do you have soda drinks? And I was like, okay, I'll have the Pepsi Coke.
Got it.
So that could have been what happened. But it seems weird to me that someone in Georgia was seeking out a Pepsi, because that's probably, 15% of the time, I'm kidding. But honestly, it's definitely not most population that would seek out.
It's sacrilege. I mean, Coke was invented in Georgia.
It's really weird to hear someone in Georgia go up and request specifically a Pepsi.
And then you link it up with the Wise potato chips found by the church. And yeah, you think there's a decent chance this person's not from Georgia.
Some out-of-town weirdo.
I will say, for my very unofficial Twitter poll, there was access to Wise chips in some areas of the Southeast. But it definitely wasn't common. So it's not the go-to chip brand by any means.
I don't think I've ever seen Wise potato chips here in South Carolina.
Thank you. I feel a bit bad. Because people were like, what? You never heard of Wise? It's a potato chip. It's everywhere. I'm like, no, it's definitely not. John, do you know what they are?
I know what they are because I grew up in New York City, and that was the type of potato chip you got. It was Wise.
Oh, so it's the standard one. It's Lay's chip somewhere else.
Yes, exactly. I recognized it right away when you tweeted that. And I felt like, oh, I've got some incredibly useful tidbit that's going to break this case wide open. Wrong.
Hey, John, can I ask you in terms of the whole story about the man coming to the church the week before, how compelling did you find that?
Well, I think that it's a church, and chances are people come there asking for help occasionally. So I would have followed up more than these police did at the time. That's wrong, by the way. They may have fallen out. Yeah, that's correct. We don't know to what degree they followed up, and perhaps it was completely clear who it was, and they've been cleared, you know. But it would seem like somebody had – absolutely, it seems significant to me. I think that, you know, somebody perhaps having some issue with – the pastor there, although it's obviously that was a different pastor. Am I correct?
Well, Harold Swain was not a pastor. He was a deacon.
Oh, he was a deacon. OK, got it. Which is more of a lay label.
It's a senior role in the church, but it's not a role of it's not the pastor.
Got it. So if somebody, say, had some issue with the pastor and came back looking for them, and perhaps Harold Swain said he's not here and the person did not take to that well, who knows? But I found it compelling. Obviously, the Robertson thing actually was the thing that knocked me out, because that's a person with a car that Dennis did not have. The timing fits in perfectly. It makes perfect sense for somebody who just lost their glasses, which, by the way, was just beautifully handled on the podcast. I'm just going to say that was that gave people chills. We got a lot of listener comments on that. It feels so tragic that memo got lost, or at least was not dealt with in any meaningful fashion. Because it feels to me like since Butch Kennedy wasn't aware of it, that it somehow just through bureaucracy wasn't seen by the person who needed to see it.
That's what I keep coming back to, because when I brought up Robertson, like we talked about him, and I've been wondering, like, why wasn't more important in the case or the file this Robertson memo? Right. And I'd sort of reached the tentative conclusion that maybe people didn't think he was to be believed. And when I asked Butch Kennedy about it, his instant reaction was, oh yeah, he used to be a deputy here. He's a good guy. He'd pay attention. He'd be a good person to observe something and know. And like, if Butch Kennedy had seen that memo, he would not have dismissed it based on that. Based on being Paul Robertson, he would have wanted to follow up more because of that.
I wanted to get to Eric Spahr because he sounded like such a promising lead. I mean, you know, it was all of it. But again, it does matter that his prescription doesn't match the glasses that were found.
I will say that's one case where actually they did not check prescription as far as I've seen.
Oh, really? Oh, gosh. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. So what I also want to know is this glasses lineup they did. Because they gave her three glasses, and she picked out the church glasses, the one that looked like his glasses. But I want to see how similar the other two, like, dummy glasses were.
And that his alibi is the thing that exonerates him in this case. Obviously, in a certain high-profile case that I won't mention, come up against an alibi that looks very likely to have been faked. Is there any reason to be suspicious of that particular alibi?
Well, so there... When I was going through the file, one thing that stood out for me is that initially they had hit this guy's boss say, I talked to his coworkers and they remember him being there that night. And I was like, wait, really? That was like 9 or 10 or 11 months ago. That's like a year ago. They're not going to recall that. But then he talked to the big bosses down in like the whatever the headquarters was somewhere in Florida. And they sent back time cards that show he was working a very long shift that night. Not that, it was in Brunswick. So technically it's like a 20-minute drive away. So theoretically, I guess you could say he could drive away and come back. But given it's a year later before they look into this guy, that's kind of the alibi you'd expect him to have or best you could do. For me, what was significant was like seeing again and again how these cases were approached by Butch Kennedy and Joe Gregory. They were methodical. They did go, there were a lot of suspects in this case and they went through a lot of them. And they were careful to like check on work alibis, time cards, pull that together, go through it. I mean, there were a lot of people to go through, so I can't say they were being overwhelmingly investigative, but they did all the things you expect them to do. So there's every reason to expect they did that in the case of Dennis Perry as well. Like, why would they have gone through and checked all the time cards for all these witnesses and then not have done it for Dennis Perry but recall doing it?
Yeah, that's a very odd hole. Well, also, we're dealing with a criminal who was savvy enough to cut the phone lines. So if this is somebody, you know, willing to put some planning into the effort, could they have planned to fake an alibi?
Possibly. Although I would say that I would lean against Eric Spahr, from what I know of him. Mm-hmm.
And also, again, why would he choose the Swains? You know, there's no other linkage other than, you know, he's purportedly a racist. You know, this is a town with, I imagine, multiple African-Americans. Was the idea to commit an arbitrary act of outrage? You know, obviously, nowadays we're more used to that kind of awful idea, but there never seemed to be any evidence of a link.
Well, this is where I go back to Lottie Bell Clayton and her story and what she saw. To me, again, it suggests that, like, the idea of a guy with shoulder-length blonde hair coming into the church and saying, I want to talk to the lead male person here. If it's not connected, what it shows is that's not weird. And doesn't mean that they actually know anyone. Doesn't mean they're actually connected to this offense. Doesn't mean that there has to be a connection between whoever this was and the Swains. Because maybe it was a robbery. Maybe it was someone who was looking for a handout and pissed off or something.
Yeah, you don't hear about church robberies much, but I imagine they do.
You do, actually.
Oh, really?
Looking into it. Yeah, we'll have more on that later, but I was shocked at all the church robberies that happened. Like, I had the same reaction. I'm starting off, I'm like, who robs a church? Turns out a lot of people rob churches.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, you got the collection plate, so that's a lot of cash and checks, I would imagine. You know, although I don't, if you, when you're in the pews frantically writing out your check as they come over, that's a little, you know, that's a little embarrassing because you don't have any cash in your pocket. I'm not saying this has happened to me. I'm not saying that.
but lack security too compared
oh,
to
yeah.
Right, most places you would think about robbing.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it makes a lot of sense to rob a church, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Although the jury is probably going to be harsher on you if you do get caught. So there's the.
That's true.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I wanted to talk about, was it Ron Rhodes,
the DBI agent? There's not much to talk about there. He was the agent in the case. He actually left the case about halfway through because he did go to the ATF. So he did not see this case through to the end. and I can't talk to them. That's about all I know.
But, okay, is it typical for the ATF to say our agents can't talk about anything, even if it's not something under the ATF's purview?
I don't know. I've wondered that, too. I think when I remember I was talking to him, he told me this, and I was like, I think I just kind of blurted out. I'm like, why would they care? Because it seems so weird to me. And he was like, well, of course they'd care. It's their agent talking. So I was like, oh, okay. So maybe he could be totally right. I have no basis for saying that that's not the case. But it did strike me as odd as well.
Yeah. I think it might be time for the guy from Two and a Half Men to call him. Only because people drop their guard for just even for 30 seconds. Because they're like, what? Alan is calling me? What? You know?
It's our weapon. Why haven't we used that yet?
I know. Exactly. We have to send me in. It's the opposite of undercover. It's what the hell is this guy doing here?
You get like 5 seconds where they actually realize what's going on, where you can ask any question and they have to give you the truth.
Yes. And then they wise up and it's like, oh, man.
Not the old Alan from Two and a Half Men trick.
Yes. I did have one other question about Leona Hamilton, who was in the Reed store. Why didn't they try to get her to chime in on the composite?
That's another mystery to me, because she is hardly she is mentioned a few places in the file. And you can tell from how she describes the suspect, that her description does form the basis of some of the initial reports about public reports, what people should look for. So obviously they found her credible in the moment. And it's like they forgot her. And to me, I mean, when I first started looking at the case, I did not see her. I did not realize how important she might be until you start hearing more and more. And you're like, wait a minute, what are the odds? How could she not have been seeing the same guy? And it's possible she didn't. But, I mean, it's not like a busy area. It's a Monday night. He bought a Pepsi. They found a Pepsi at the scene. He had the same long, blondish hair. She saw darker up top, blonder on bottom, which to me suggests possibly someone dyed their hair, which was interesting. He's a short guy, slender guy. I mean, everything what she describes matches up very well with the different descriptions we have from the people in the church. So to suddenly decide that she saw nothing, what she saw is totally unrelated, seems bizarre to me. And to never show her a lineup, to never show her Dennis, to never call her at trial, I don't understand any of that.
And it would seem to me like the defense, if I was on the defense here, I would try to put up a blizzard of sort of alternate suspects. And obviously defense attorneys do this all the time. I'm right about this, Colin, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Did the defense attorney deploy that strategy at all? Because it seems like you have, so many options here.
Oh, no. No, they did not. They did one and one alone. We'll get more into that later.
And it is a question, John. It's, you don't want to look desperate as the defense where you're throwing out these names when it seems there's not much evidence to support their guilt. But here, I think as we laid out in the episode, there's pretty compelling arguments. We have these bookends here, these people who probably saw the shooter right before the shooting and then Roberson there after the shooting, and yet none of them really play a role at all in describing the person that they saw or what they saw, the vehicle being a car, being able to recognize the car from the sound it made, and it's just not really an emphasis.
Yeah, which, by the way, I looked up. Apparently it is a thing. I actually talked to Joey Watkins about this because I was on the phone with him when I was thinking about it. I'm like, I don't know cars at all. And I'm like, Joey, could someone actually tell a Chrysler by the starter noise? He's like, yeah, of course. How do you know
Joey
that?
Joey could, yeah.
Wow.
He was like, obviously you can tell that. But he's like, yeah, of course you can. If it's a certain, I forget the year, it's between a certain 65 to 80 or something. I'm making that up, but that time period roughly. Apparently Chrysler starters have this whining noise to it. And if you go on YouTube, you can hear it. It's just very whiny, I guess, is how I would describe it.
Wow. I am impressed at the people with that level of acuity for that. I suppose things about your environment, but the cars are all over the place on this. That's the Plymouth Duster. There was the Catalina. There doesn't seem to be any, I can see why investigators wouldn't necessarily fixate on any kind of car.
They totally fixated on the kind of car.
Oh, they did. Okay. I'm wrong about everything today.
It's a Duster, apparently. By the time you get to trial, for some reason, it's definitely a Duster. But the initial reports don't even really mention Duster so much as it's Chrysler, Dodge Dart, Valiant. The people involved seem to have more idea what cars were like. So I guess they're their opinion's more trustworthy. But to me, looking at all these car types, I'm like, yeah, it's a car. It's an old boxy looking car. The Catalina and the various Chryslers they were going after, to me, look roughly the same. But then again, I don't know anything about cars. What's weird, though, again, is that we have all these witnesses who plausibly describe the suspect with a car of some sort. And yet in the final theory of the case, there's the killer definitely doesn't use a car. There's no car involved at all. Dennis does not use a car to commit this crime. They're pretty adamant about that.
Yeah, it seems like once again, a prosecution is melding a crime to fit the few kernels of information they have, even if it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, like they had this information and they didn't want to use it because it ruined their theory of Dennis. But like the car is like the one thing they kind of know starting out.
Okay, I've got some listener questions. Here's one from A. Suter Clark, who says, is there any consequence for police who lose key evidence that would be exculpatory? If we know witness interviews existed that tend to show Dennis didn't commit the crime and the defense never got him, isn't that a Brady? Which, of course, we got into a little bit. But is there any penalty?
Well, if you listen to the testimony from Sheriff Bill Smith at this trial, he suggests that he fired Butch Kennedy for losing the evidence. So theoretically, there's a penalty there. Of course, the evidence didn't go missing until after Butch left the office. That's not why he was fired, but he does try and – that's the prosecution's strategy for handling this, to say, yes, stuff was lost, but it was the original investigators that lost it, and they were dealt with because of it.
And in terms of whether it's a Brady violation, there's a Supreme Court case, Arizona versus Youngblood, and it says if evidence is lost or destroyed in the absence of bad faith, that's not a due process violation. If it's merely potentially exculpatory evidence, and by that we mean we're not sure whether it's helpful or harmful to the defendant. And so the state in a case like this would say, yeah, we lost some of these interviews. We don't remember what was in them, or at least we're claiming there's nothing exculpatory. And unfortunately, the way the system is set up, that really is just not going to be a grounds for relief for the defendant unless they can find a smoking gun that shows that this was bad faith on the one hand, or wait, there was a smoking gun, there was exculpatory evidence in here that helps me.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, I mean, I'm not saying it suggests it did happen because there's no evidence it did. But if the reason we don't have transcripts for all the interviews is because they went through and pulled out some of them, that would be Brady. But right now, yeah. What it looks like happened is that like the transcripts got lost and the tapes got lost, so we just don't even know what's on them.
We've got two questions, actually. One is from Malcolm Tucker saying, are we absolutely sure the guy with the Franken-specs hadn't forged his time cards?
We're sure he didn't forge them because they came from his employer and from the big boss office that owned the grocery store chain. So at the very least, he was not the one that forged them. I guess you could argue he like falsely clocked in or out or something.
Well, wait a minute. Aha! David Taylor chimes in with, seems if Spar had a similar vehicle or access to one, he'd be my top suspect regardless of his time card. Overnight stocking jobs are usually unsupervised, and you could easily skip out for a few hours. Seems funny his alibi is okay and Perry's not.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of joking about this earlier with someone about how, like, you introduce any suspect in this case, and, like, it seems like everyone's like, oh, my God, it's the best suspect now. Because there were a lot of suspects with, like, plausible explanations for how, like, you know, like the guy lying about his alibi and happened to match the profile perfectly, or Spar, who confesses to the crime. it's just so bizarre to me that Dennis surfaced to the top as the number one suspect, given, like, the huge pile of suspects, the huge pile of, like, people with plausible-sounding connections or better stories to explain why they're the killer. And yet Dennis is the one, I think mostly by chance, they ended up settling on. So based on what we said so far in the show, it may sound like any person is a particularly good suspect. I would caution you from thinking that way because literally there's over 100 suspects in this case. Each one's like kind of better than the last in a sort of way. So I would not say that this guy's the best fit based on all we know. Okay, there's always tons of evidence for a bunch of these guys that seems to fit perfectly. You're like, obviously, this guy's the best killer. And there's always one or two facts that you're like, oh, okay, guess not.
Yeah. Yeah, an ironclad alibi, you know, blows that all out of the water. Or a prescription that doesn't match. Although you said that his prescription is unclear at this point.
You're right. Spar's
actually, we don't know.
We don't know Spar's. And here's one weird theory. Spar's father, they worked in the affidavit, worked for the life insurance company that handled the life insurance claims for Harold and Thelma Swain, which they bring up as if that somehow could be relevant. But you're like, wait, what? Like, how could that possibly have worked into the theory here?
Oh, gosh. The idea being that you would kill them so that your dad could pay off the insurance, or so that your dad could not pay off the insurance. I don't. Okay. Here's an interesting one from Free Keith Davis Jr. of the House of Now, who says, you said that only one of the suspects had vision that would be better with the found glasses. Does that mean all those suspects had had eye exams and the police collected them? And what was the welder's prescription?
The only suspect actually had like an eye exam done to him personally is Dennis, I believe. For everyone else that wore glasses where they did do it, they would just went. They either used the glasses to figure out what the prescription was, or they found the person's doctor and went to them that way. What we know is that the prescription for this person was, it's OD plus 3.75 minus 0.5 times 007 and OS plus 2.50, which I don't know what that means. I know that OS is left eye and OD is right eye. And that the plus means they're farsighted. So.
And this from Sarah Kellen, who's quoting from the episode. It was someone who was driving erratically because they'd been half blinded after losing their glasses. Mic drop. So that's just a comment.
Yeah, maybe it was a drive. That's what I kept going in circles about. Like, I talked to Robertson, and I just felt so confident this guy was literally zero doubts at all. This guy saw what he saw. The others, I wouldn't have that kind of confidence just because you never know. I know Sammy Williams. In fact, Butch Kennedy was not sure about him. He's the one who saw the car before the shooting and was gone after. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, Butch Kennedy remembers that he had hesitations about believing that story wholeheartedly. And I don't know why exactly. But the story itself is pretty, I mean, that's all there is to it. Whereas with Paul Robertson, that guy saw that car driving erratically. I am completely confident of that. On the other hand, there could have been a drunk driver and a killer out that night.
Wouldn't it have been great if the drunk driver killed the killer?
Yeah.
That would have been awesome. This from Supreme's mom. Any updates on the Willie Vesey case?
Well, yeah, we were just talking about the alibi and the time card. And of course, Willie Vesey, by way of review, is the Philadelphia case where he had a time card that shows he was clocked in at the time the murder of the Jamaican took place. And I do know the Conviction Integrity Unit in Philadelphia is currently actively reviewing his case. And so we hope in the next couple of weeks or months that we'll have an update on his case.
You know, it's fascinating because on Undisclosed, people still, you know, listen to the first season. It's, you know, contemporaneous with our new season because it's always available. And we still get questions about Adnan Syed. Like we just got this one from Michael O'Neill saying, what will it take for Adnan Syed to get a fair shake and be freed? Complete miscarriage of justice. My grandma moves faster at 92 than the Baltimore justice system. So, Colin, I was curious. I think the state's brief just came out today. Do you want to fill us in on it a little bit?
Yeah. And so, again, by way of review, this is a case where they have three levels of appellate courts in Maryland, and the first two have granted Adnan a new trial. Specifically, the Court of Special Appeals, the intermediate court, found it was ineffective assistance of counsel not to contact alibi witness Asia McClain. There's two prongs to that, deficient performance and prejudice. Prejudice meaning if she had contacted her, there's a reasonable probability the outcome at trial would have been different. The state today filed its opening brief with the Court of Appeals of Maryland. That's the highest state Supreme Court in Maryland. And from what I can tell in reading through it briefly, it's largely a cut and paste job. They've basically taken what they argued before. They're arguing it again. In terms of prejudice, it's almost completely a cut and paste job. There's no case law cited. I think it's a pretty weak argument. In terms of deficient performance, they're relying again on alibi by routine and claiming that was what Gutierrez was pursuing and there was no need to contact Asia McClain. As I've said before, alibi by routine is an oxymoron. You can't have an alibi by routine. It's by definition what you did that day and not your typical practice. And essentially their argument really is Gutierrez was deceased, and with a deceased attorney, you can't prove deficient performance and ineffective assistance because you don't know what that attorney was thinking. I think their citations on that are flawed. I think it's the wrong analysis. I think there's no grounds, really, where an attorney can refuse to interview an alibi witness. And so it's just, I think, regurgitated arguments. I don't see them winning the alibi issue on appeal.
But it's interesting that if, as you said, that it appears that they've basically recycling the same arguments, that doesn't sound like they've put a lot of effort into this. And is Thiru Vignaraja listed as the, is he still the appellant, I guess, in this case? What would you call him?
He's listed as the attorney for the attorney general, which is the party that is representing the state here in this appeal. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't look to me like a lot of effort. I think they're thinking we lost 2-1 at the Court of Special Appeals. We have Grafe's dissent, and let's hope that the justices on the highest court agree with her and not with the majority.
Yeah, I've definitely seen appeals that put more effort in this one.
It's only fascinating to me because Theeravik Nuraja lost his bid for public office. He was eliminated in the primary. So it seems like he's got some free time. for him to drop the ball now, it's a little it's interesting to me, especially since, you know, he's still flogging that alibi by routine thing that doesn't have any actual legal precedent.
Yeah, and that's the weird part for me, and that is something that Steve Klepper identified on Twitter and I wrote about in my blog, is just I understand taking the dissent and arguing that to the higher court, but the dissent doesn't talk about alibi routine. This is sort of Theroux's own creation, and he's going to try and float it by these justices in the highest court, and I don't see that taking wind at all.
I imagine Justin Brown will have something to say about that.
Yeah, I would think so.
That's Adnan's attorney, just FYI. That's all the listener questions I have for today. Was there anything that you felt you wanted to chime in about?
Not that I can recall, other than that. I super hope we get those tapes one day. I'm sure they're shitty quality, but I'll play them on this podcast anyway because I want them so bad.
Well, I hope so too. Well, I would love to hear his walk around, Butch Cassidy's walk around, because that is, the most accurate thing we have of what the scene was like.
Yeah, we do have photos. We do have some photos. Some are missing. I will say the diagrams they made were really, really good. They were very detail-oriented. Joe Gregory, the GBI agent, was kind of methodical and, they're all hand drawings. It's 85, but, carefully mapping out each piece of evidence and how many feet it was from every other piece of evidence. So for the stuff in the vestibule, even with the missing photos, I feel pretty good about where stuff is. It's the stuff outside. We have no clue where any of it can be found.
Well, I'm looking forward to next week's episode, and it was such a pleasure talking to you guys.
All right, you too, John.
Well, there you have it. That's the addendum. And just so you know, we will have another one next week. We also have something new here at Undisclosed. We now have a Patreon. It is at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And you can join up at any level that you'd like to. It gets you a bonus episode with Susan, Rabia, and Colin, where they talk about cases that interest them. And another thing you should know about the Patreon, besides the fact that it helps them make the show so very much, is that none of that money will go to me. The guy who did Two and a Half Men for 12 years doesn't really need it. So don't worry, your money will be spent where it should be. If you feel like checking out our website, it is at undisclosed-podcast.com. There's a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you can make a donation to there. I am donating all of my fees to the Georgia Innocence Project. You can find them on the web at georgiainnocenceproject.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle, @UndisclosedPod, and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I want to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon, as well as Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Patrick Cortez composed our addenda theme, and Methil Tellen is our project manager. Thank you all so much for listening, and I can't wait to talk to you again next week.
Do y'all hear that?
No, I heard a little, a...
Yeah, that's my cat's fighting. Oh, my God. I swear they time it from when we start recording. Sorry.
That was your cat...
Yeah, no, but whenever I start recording, they start fighting. It's like they know.
They want your attention, Susan. That's what it is. I mean, I think it's time for the cat whisperer to step in here and say that you heard was her cats fighting.
I can't find my lap, so they object.
Yes. I think the biggest victims here are your cats, really. You know, I mean, yes, Dennis Perry is in jail. Yes, there are tragedies all through the justice system, but your cats are suffering. Oh, wait.